Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll free, 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome. It's Thursday on Catholic Answers Live. As a matter of fact, I think it's Thursday in the whole world. And on Thursdays, we do open forum here. Open forum means if you have a question about the Catholic faith, if there's something you'd like to know about the Catholic Church, what we believe, what we do, or why we believe and do those things, this is your opportunity. 888-318-7884. The lines tend to fill up relatively quickly on open forum days, so you might want to start dialing if you'd like to get in this hour. 888-318-7884. Both hours, our guest is Jimmy Akin today. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, author of many things. I've got a few of them right here in front of me. The Fathers Know Best, The Drama of Salvation, A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. Hello, Jimmy.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going really well. I like when we do these two-hour things.
I do, too. And speaking of hours, it's actually not Thursday all over the world.
Oh, it's not. Where is it?
Well, so we're in the Pacific time zone, which is like 9 hours behind Greenwich Mean Time.
Okay.
But there's only 24 hours in a day on Earth. So if you go, 15 hours forward, you'll be in Friday.
And so like in the Pacific, somewhere in the Pacific.
It's already like our friends Friday. In Guam, for example, I think are probably already in Friday.
Oh, yeah.
Although really the international dateline kind of zigs and zags crazily through the Pacific Ocean.
Right. But we have listeners in Micronesia. They say hello every now and then on Facebook.
Awesome.
So that maybe they're in Friday. I apologize. None of you in those places can have open line then because it's Friday where you are. I mean, not open forum. I said open line.
They can have it. They just have it on Friday.
Okay.
They can call in. They're welcome to.
All right. You're more generous than I am. Again, 888-318-7884 is that number, 888-31-TRUTH. Jimmy, so here we are in the midst of summer, and an apologist like yourself, is there a seasonal thing to it at all? Is summer slower maybe than, say, around the Easter season? Or how does the ebb and flow of your work with the public, for example, go?
Well, I'm always interacting with the public in various ways, but there are certain things like fundraising slows down during the summer because people are taking vacations, they're out of pocket and so forth. But for the most part, things aren't driven seasonally, but they're driven by the liturgical calendar. So every Christmas, we've got lots of when Jesus was born questions and is Christmas based on a pagan holiday? Spoiler warning. The answer is no. Then every Lent and Easter, we have all kinds of Lent and Easter-related questions. And so it's really driven – it's not driven seasonally, but liturgically.
And liturgically, I mean, we have a big feast day, August 15th.
Mm-hmm.
But in summer for Catholics, I guess, is like summer for everything else. It's lower.
It's a little slow in terms of major holy days.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's because of the way the liturgical calendar is structured. The liturgical calendar is driven principally by the date of Easter and secondarily by the date of Christmas. And so things tend to coordinate. The major stuff tends to fall in the latter part of the year and in the first part of the year, in the winter and the spring.
Again, 888-31-TRUTH, our number. If you've got it, go ahead.
In fact, that's where the word Lent comes from. It's the Old English word for spring.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
It's not that stuff you find under the dryer.
I was going to say, I thought it had something to do with your socks. We got already, look at that, Jimmy. Lines filling up for you already. So shall we try to get a question before we have to go to a break? All right, Ryan in Midland, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers app. You are up first with Jimmy Akin today. Your question, please.
All right, Jimmy, my question is, before the first Eucharistic prayer or the Roman canon developed in the Missal, does the Church have any real records of what the Eucharistic prayer would have sounded like in the early days of the Church and Mass? Like, to give a brief example, in the Didache where it says, "We give thee thanks, our Father," and et cetera, if that's truly a Eucharistic prayer, would that have been the standard used prayer that they would have all used back then, or is it possible some of them might have used an anaphora or some other prayer that would now correspond to what's called the anaphoras of St. John Chrysostom, St. Basil the Great, and St. James, and so forth?
The idea that there was ever a single Eucharistic prayer that was used by all Christians everywhere is true if you're talking about the night of the Last Supper, because Jesus said the Eucharistic prayer on that night. But after that, diversification began, and we even see diversification in the New Testament itself, because if you look at the Gospels of Matthew and Mark, they both have words of institution, which would have been used in the Eucharistic prayer, that are similar to each other, but they're not quite the same. And if you look in the Gospel of Luke and in 1 Corinthians, you find other words of institution. They're still recognizably the words of institution, but they're drawing on a different liturgical tradition than the one found in Matthew and Mark. And so right there within the New Testament, we see diversification on the words of institution themselves. From what we can tell, it appears that the words that in the Eucharistic prayer that surrounded the words of institution were even more diverse. In fact, in the earliest stages, there may not have been any particular set words. The priests and bishops who were presiding may have actually improvised, from what we can tell. But eventually, certain standards developed, just like in other forms of improvisation. You tend to repeat certain patterns that become established, like jazz improvisation, for example. Even though they may rearrange the bits, jazz musicians frequently have a certain pattern of improvisation that they use on a regular basis. They may vary it a little bit, but it's still recognizably the same. And that happened in the liturgy, as far as we can tell, as well. But eventually, you did get people writing these things down in documents, at least as sample prayers. And the Didache is an example of that, although I should note that there's some question about specific passages in the Didache. That's a document from the first century. It was a kind of church manual, how to do things in church. And it there's some debate about particular passages in it and whether they were prayers said during the Eucharist per se, or whether they were prayers said at the beginning of a love feast that was frequently celebrated in conjunction with the Eucharist. I know by the third century, by the 200s, we have a document called the Apostolic Tradition, which is sometimes attributed to St. Hippolytus, and he lays out prayers that were used at least as sample prayers during the Eucharist. We have other documents from the early centuries that attest to different prayers that were used at least as sample prayers in the Eucharist. And over the course of time, these solidified and became more widely used, and eventually gave rise to the different anaphoras or Eucharistic prayers that we find today in the different Catholic rites.
Ryan, thank you very, very much for that question. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, Catholic practice, Catholic life, we'd love to try to get you an answer. 888-318-7884 is the number. And when Jimmy's here, we'll take a little broader array of questions. If you have a question of a more generally religious nature or a philosophical question, we'd be happy to take those as well. 888-31-TRUTH. Before we go to the break, I just want to let you know, I get these little speaker things, and I'm on it, Jimmy. I'm giving a talk at 6 p.m. on Sunday, August 5th.
Okay, where?
At St. Elizabeth Seton Parish in Carlsbad, California. The talk is, by the way, is called Whatever Happened to the Modern World.
Oh.
And, yeah.
It's going away?
Something happened to the modern world. No, it's going a little bit nuts.
Oh, okay.
And it didn't start out that way, necessarily. Not everything modern is bad, but take a look at that. If you want to call the parish for more information, you can call 760-438-3393. That's Sunday, August 5th, 6 p.m., St. Elizabeth, Carlsbad. We'll be right back after this with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin.
Call and ask Jimmy your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Catherine Zeltner. There are so many misconceptions when it comes to abortion and assisted suicide. It's really confusing, and I think for a lot of people, they don't know how to talk about these things. EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, we help to change that. We help to really untangle these web of lies. Listeners can expect to become informed and then grow more confident so that they can then discuss and dialogue these issues, and together we can really impact culture in that way.
EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on EWTN Radio.
Pope Francis said, "All of us are called to mature in our work as evangelizers. We want to have better training, a deepening love, and a clearer witness to the gospel. St. Paul Street Evangelization's online school of evangelization will equip you with the tools you need to be an effective evangelist. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you're unable to give, we'll set you up for free. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy's senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And the topic is whatever might be on your mind about the Catholic faith. If you have a question, 888-318-7884 is the number. Oh, remember that guy called yesterday? He said he had to listen to me say the number five times before he wanted to call. It was his first time calling, so I'll say it more slowly.
Thank you.
888-318-7884.
There you go.
Don't give me the face.
I'm amazed, you know, when I listen to my voicemail and people will say, "Hi, my name is blah, 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 I'm blah, 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 and my phone number is blah, blah, blah," and it's like, okay.
Yeah,
if you really want me to call you back,
you're going to need to do better than that.
You're going to need to say it slowly and twice.
Yeah. Yeah. Some people say that on there. They'll say your number slowly and twice. All right, I'll work on that. But Isaiah in Logan, Utah, watching on Facebook. Thanks for joining us on Facebook. Logan, your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy, how's it going? Can you hear me okay?
Yes. What's your question?
Fantastic. So I was wondering, you wrote that excellent piece just a little bit in the Catholic magazine where you talked about Humana Vitae and so forth, which was awesome, by the way.
Thank you.
And I was wondering, in terms of the clergy, you know, if you read Unitatis Reintegratio, mm-hmm. it talks about a hierarchy of truths.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, too, if you flip back to Lumen Gentium, number 25, and it talks about religious docility or obsequium, so surrendering of mind and will. So I'm just wondering, why is it sometimes with teachings that aren't sort of capital D dogma, but sort of lower D doctrine, why isn't it that the church sort of doesn't say, you know, after further study and examination of conscience and not rejecting, say, the episcopate as such in their office, that there is room for someone in their conscience to have at least a disagreement for a time.
Okay. So we probably want to clarify a few things. The first one is the concept of the hierarchy of truths. Everything in the hierarchy of truths is true, hence the name.
Mm-hmm.
But there are certain truths that are more central to the Christian faith than others. For example, the existence of God is a more central truth than the existence of angels. And the incarnation of Christ is a more central truth than, say, the fact that there are Ten Commandments. Now, all four of those are truths, but some are central, pivotal truths that other things depend on, like the existence of angels is dependent on the existence of God. And subsidiary things about, say, the life of Christ, like the fact he was born in Bethlehem, is subsidiary to the fact he became incarnate at all. And so the concept of the hierarchy of truths doesn't have to do with their level of authority. That's the other thing that you mentioned, the difference between dogmas and doctrines. Dogmas, the way the term is used in the church today, are doctrines, they're teachings, that have two special qualities. The first special quality is they've been infallibly defined. So they're absolutely guaranteed to be true. The second special quality they have is they're divinely revealed. So that's what a dogma is. It's a truth that is both infallibly defined and is something that is divinely revealed and that the church has said this is divinely revealed. So you can have things that have different levels of centrality in the hierarchy of truths that are dogmas. For example, the existence of God is a dogma. The church has infallibly taught that God reveals his own existence to us, and so that's a dogma. But so is the existence of angels. Even though angels are much lower, their existence is much lower in the hierarchy of truths than God's existence, nevertheless, it's been revealed by God that angels exist, and the church has infallibly taught that by the ordinary and universal magisterium. Now, not all doctrines are dogmas. Some doctrines are truths that the church has infallibly defined, even though they're not necessarily divinely revealed. And then there are teachings that the church has that are not infallibly defined. They're sometimes called non-infallible teachings or non-definitive teachings or non-irreformable teachings. Those are just three different ways of saying the same thing. They are teachings of the church, but they haven't been taught in a definitive, infallible, or irreformable way. And so they could hypothetically one day change. And even though you don't hear it discussed a lot, actually the church acknowledges that there are situations where a theologian or an ordinary member of the faithful may have difficulty accepting a non-definitive teaching, and that there are you shouldn't do that easily or eagerly, and you should try to resolve whatever difficulties you may have with such a teaching. But it's acknowledged that we can have difficulties accepting such teachings, and that we can be in good conscience, potentially, it's not a guarantee, but we can potentially be in good conscience even though we have a disagreement with non-definitive teachings, ones that haven't been infallibly taught. That's something that's discussed in a document that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith released in 1990. It's called Donum Veritatis, and it discusses this. There's also a very interesting companion piece that then-Cardinal Ratzinger released on the same day as Donum Veritatis. They're both on the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith's website. And it also, this is a theme I discuss in my upcoming book, Teaching with Authority, which will be out in just a few months.
We'll leave it there, Isaiah, because there are lots of people today lined up to get their questions addressed. I hope that was helpful to you, Isaiah. We go now to Andrew here in California, watching on YouTube. Andrew, your question for Jimmy. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, hello, Jimmy. Hi. I actually have your book. I got it for free when I called in one day, and I wanted to...
Thank you. Andrew, just so you know, it sounds like you may be on speaker or something. Can you please talk directly into the phone?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Okay. Can you take us off speaker?
Yeah, sure. Let me do that.
Okay.
Is that better?
That's much better. Speaker, phone, and radio are mortal enemies. Yeah.
Got it. Gotcha. I just wanted to ask you a question that's been kind of troubling for the last few weeks.
Uh-huh.
I'm a practicing Catholic, so this isn't coming from a hostile place. But so my question is basically, did God die on the cross?
You know, yes.
Because if Jesus is God and mm-hmm. God is to be, and Jesus died on the cross, why is it that existence did not cease?
Okay. This has to do with the nature of death. Death doesn't mean ceasing to exist. Death means your body stops working. And so Jesus was God, and he had a body. Because he was incarnate, that's what being incarnate means, to be in the flesh, and his body stopped working on the cross. And so while his body was not working, he was physically dead, but that didn't mean he ceased to exist any more than it means we cease to exist when our bodies stop working. We continue to have souls that exist even after our body has stopped working. And Jesus had a human soul that continued to exist after his body stopped working. And in addition to that, he also had a divine nature that also continued to exist when his body stopped working. And it was through his divine nature that he kept the entire universe going, together with the Father and the Spirit, who also share that same divine nature.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is a flaw in my own like understanding. It probably is. I just, because that reminds me of because it makes me like think. Okay, so I thought their two natures aren't separate. You know, that they're one and the same when it comes to Jesus.
No,
I don't know if that kind of reminds me of that, like when Protestants say that, that was part of Jesus' human like nature, instead of like, for instance, what is it like with the virgin birth? I can't really think of a good example. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. The key thing to understand is that Jesus does have a divine and a human nature, and they are not separated, but they are distinct. So one of the early heresies in the church actually was a view called monophysitism, or one-natureism. And the idea was that when he became incarnate, you had a divine nature and a human nature, and they essentially fused together into one nature. And that's a heresy, because at that point, Jesus would not be fully God or fully man. He would be a mixture of the two, kind of like if you took me and hacked off certain body parts and replaced them with, you know, cybernetic arms and limbs to make me a cyborg.
You wish, Jimmy.
I wouldn't any longer be all. I wouldn't be completely flesh. I would be part flesh and part metal. In fact, I even might become more machine than man now. Jesus remained fully God, and he had to, because the divine nature cannot change. God's essence is outside of time and changeless, and so his divine nature cannot fuse with a human nature, but it can be united to a human nature. And so some of the ancient creeds that express this talk about, like the Athanasian Creed, talk about how his two natures are united without division and without separation, but they are nevertheless distinct from each other. And so since Jesus had a human body, and that body stopped functioning, we can say that Jesus died. Since Jesus is also one of the persons of the Trinity, Jesus is God, and so by what's known as the communication of idioms, that's the technical theological term for it, we can also say God died on the cross, in the sense not that the divine nature passed out of existence, but in the sense that the divine nature remained and Jesus's physical body stopped working for a time. And these distinctions can be a little difficult, and it took the church a while to work out the best way to express them. So it's understandable. They can be a little hard to process, but those are the essential distinctions we need to be making.
Okay, Andrew?
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, that makes a little bit more sense. Is there any more kind of Christology, introduction to Christology that would be helpful for like something like this?
Yeah. So one place you may want to look, obviously, is the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Another place to look is a book called Fundamentals of Catholic Dogma by Ludwig Ott, O-T-T, and he goes into this. Also, any number of books on heresy will talk about the early Christological heresies and how the church ended up navigating its way through the different ideas that were being proposed. So you might want to check out a book on heresy as well.
Thanks, Andrew. Appreciate that call. It is open forum today here on Catholic Answers Live. 888-31 Truth is the number. Sometimes I get the sense, Jimmy, that like we can have a degree of understanding about, like Andrew said, Christology. Who is this?
Mm-hmm. The study of Christ.
Yeah. But we also have to have a kind of humility that it this is beyond us.
Yeah.
You know,
we're dealing with the upper ranges of what we as humans are able to understand at this point. It's kind of like, you know, in science fiction, people will say, well, if we encountered aliens, we might even have trouble understanding them because of how different they are from us. Well, God is infinitely above us.
Right.
And so we're never going to, with our finite, puny little human minds, going to understand all of the divine mystery. And so it's only to be expected that when God communicates certain things to us, we're going to find it a little hard to understand. But because we can trust God, because he's the source of all truth, we nevertheless can know these things are true, even though we may have trouble comprehending them fully.
Jimmy Akin is our guest. Our topic, whatever is on your mind as far as the Catholic Church, wanting to understand the Catholic Church, the Catholic faith. Special invitation to anyone who is not a Catholic. I don't believe we've had a non-Catholic caller yet today, and we feel like we've been a little short of them. What's that?
We welcome them.
We welcome them, yeah. We'd love it if you have any question, whether that question is challenging or just...
Wildly curious. Information.
Yeah, we're happy to take that call. 888-318-7884.
Catholic Answers Live.
Are faith and science compatible? Are they friends or foes? Catholic Answers Magazine is tackling that question and others with our very special Faith and Science issue, delving deep into what is arguably one of the most debated topics of our day. Want to be sure to get your copy? Subscribe right now to the best Catholic apologetics magazine anywhere by calling 818-487-2011 or going to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com. We'll take an in-depth look at the Catholic view of evolution with Dr. Stacy Trisenkos. We'll review the most common misconceptions about how faith and science stand in opposition with Dr. Chris Kazor. And apologist Trent Horn will refute the skeptic's claim that something can come from nothing, plus so much more. Don't miss out on what will be a virtual handbook on one of the most important issues of our day. Call 818-487-2011 or go to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com right now to get subscriptions for yourself and those you love. Share the faith. Defend the faith. Catholic Answers Magazine. From Catholic Answers, the most trusted name in Catholic apologetics.
Hey everyone, this is Carlo Broussard, and I'm here to tell you about a very special promotion we look forward to every year, our annual store-wide summer sale in the online shop at Catholic.com. This spectacular online event includes savings of 10 to 25% and more in some cases on every book, tract, CD, DVD, ebook, and MP3 we carry, including my new book, Prepare the Way. With lower prices and a great selection, it's by far the best online Catholic sale of the summer. So log on now and all this month to the shop at shop.catholic.com and take advantage of our very special prices. You know it's all good stuff because it's from the people you know and trust at Catholic Answers.
I'm Gloria Purvis for Jack Williams. Tomorrow, Paul Gondreau on Humanae Vitae, and we'll continue our sacred music series. Tomorrow, Morning Glory on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open forum, Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour and next. If you ever want to come and... hang out in the studio while we do the show. We love it when you do that. We have a couple guests from Houston, Texas with us, Adrian and Hallie. Thank you for coming, Adrian and Hallie. You just give a call to the front desk here and maybe a day or two or a month or something before you come. And then we make the arrangements for you to get the tour and come hang out. And it makes everybody feel good when we got folks in the studio with us. And 619, oh no, I'm going to forget the number. You'll have to give it to me in a minute, Nick.
Which number?
The front desk number.
Front desk 619-387-7200.
Okay, and then you can come
take
the tour.
That's 619-387-7200.
I like how you repeated that slowly and clearly.
Thank you.
Very well done, Jimmy. D in Northwest Missouri, watching on YouTube, you are up next. D, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. During Lent, I was reading a book, and it was being very helpful, and then I ran across a statement that just blew my mind, and I couldn't accept. So this was the statement. Experience leads me to believe that people are intrinsically good. that they would rather live with each other's happiness than misery, and that when their survival is not threatened, people will go out of their way to help others. Well, if people are intrinsically good, why did Jesus have to die for us?
Yeah, so I'm not sure who's writing or in what context they're writing. I think that they're expressing a truth, but it's a limited truth. The truth is that humans are social creatures, and we're like dogs or wolves. We're not like cats that live primarily solitary existences and only come together for mating and things like that. We live on an ongoing basis as group in a group setting. And so consequently, God built us so that we have pro-social traits, that we do things to help out other members of our group and society and so forth, just like the different members of a wolf pack support each other. Our species is unique in that we have an ability to care for other people and to show altruism that even goes beyond our own species, to where we help out other species too. And as long as we're not threatened, much of the time, not always, but much of the time, we'll go out of our way to help other people or even help other creatures that don't even belong to our species. Some people take it to the extent of if they find a bug in their house and they don't want the bug in their house, rather than just squash the bug, they may go to elaborate efforts to get the bug out some other way. And so we're really unique in that. And that may be, that's certainly at least a truth that the author is pointing out, that we do have these tendencies. But if the author means more than that and is denying that humans also have sin, then that's obviously false, because it's also obvious we do have sin. And in fact, like Cardinal John Henry Newman in his Apologia Pro Vita Sua, his biography, his intellectual autobiography, he talks about how one of the most certain truths for him after the existence of God is the reality of original sin. Because you look at all the sin and suffering that's occurred in human history caused by humans, it's obvious that we are also a fundamentally broken species. And so the truth is that we're a mix in the present state of our existence. We have aspects of goodness that are intrinsic to us, meaning God built them into us, so we are intrinsically good in some ways. We're also extrinsically good in some ways. We have some qualities of goodness that aren't built into us, but that we've acquired by experience, like training ourselves to do different good things. However, at the same time, we also have a fundamental brokenness that we also inherit and that is also intrinsic to us. So even though fundamentally everything that God created is good on its base level, we have an added overlay of brokenness and sin that we also have to deal with, and consequently, since we can't rescue ourselves from this situation, we needed Jesus to become incarnate and to redeem us from it.
Does that work for you, Dee?
Well, it helps a little, I think. I thought because of original sin that we are intrinsically evil.
That's not the church's understanding. A passage that may help you think about this is found in the letter of James, where James talks about how other human beings, and he's talking about people even in a sinful condition, are made in the image of God. Well, if we're made in the image of God, even in our sinful condition, then there's something intrinsic to us that's good about us. Intrinsic doesn't mean totally. We're not totally good. Intrinsic means inbuilt. And everything that exists has inbuilt goodness because it's created by God, and everything, this is another passage of Scripture actually, everything God creates is good, and he doesn't despise any of his creations. Whereas we do have problems that are intrinsic, we have intrinsic brokenness and sinfulness, we also have intrinsic good qualities, such as the fact we're made in the image of God, and he's given us the capacity to do good in various ways. Those are good things.
Dee, we will have to leave it there. Thank you so much for that call. I hope that that was helpful. I hope that was a good answer. And we go now to Paulina in Seattle, Washington, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Paulina, thank you for downloading the app onto your phone. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Thank you. My question is, what happens to our guardian angel after we die, and if we will meet him in heaven?
If we will meet him in heaven?
Yeah.
Was that the question?
Yes,
okay. So we don't know what happens with our guardian angel when we die. We may have an ongoing relationship with him in heaven, although he wouldn't be performing as much of a guardian function at that point. But he might still serve as an intermediary between us and God, which is one of the things that guardian angels do for us now. Jesus, in fact, in the key passage talking about guardian angels in the New Testament, Jesus indicates that the angels of little children never fail to see the face of his Father, meaning they've got instant access to the throne room in heaven. They need to intercede for a child. They're going to be able to get an audience with God. And so that kind of intermediary role is something that, you know, angels might continue to do for us even after we no longer are in need of being guarded from spiritual dangers. On the other hand, it may be that we don't have an ongoing relationship actively anyway with our former guardian angels. They might be assigned other duties. We just don't know. We'll have to wait and see. In terms of will we meet them in heaven, again, this is something we're not directly told, but it's certainly a reasonable thing to speculate. And so I wouldn't think it's an unreasonable thing to suppose that we'll meet our guardian angel, but it's not something I could prove.
Okay, Paulina?
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
Well, hang on, Paulina. I want to send you a book. I want to send you Jimmy's A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, because I have a feeling in my heart that you might be Jimmy's favorite caller today. And that has to do with you just
I
asked,
have a big heart.
Yes, you do have a big heart. But you asked your question so directly,
yes,
we love that. So
love that.
Hang on the phone, and Marie will get your digits if you want to give them to us, and we'll send you A Daily Defense. Thanks so much, Paulina. I got time to do another call. Sherry in Washington listening on KHSF out of Walla Walla, Washington. Thanks for calling from Walla Walla, Sherry. Your question for Jimmy.
Yes, sir. I am confused about the different Johns that are in the Gospels.
Okay.
I mean, there's the John that had his head on a platter, and mm-hmm. there's a John who was exiled, and then there was a John who was the next, had his head to the breast of Jesus at the Last Supper, and I'm confused about who all these Johns are.
Okay. Well, it's understandable that you would be, because we do have reference to multiple people in the New Testament named John, and it's not always clear how they should match up to each other. And scholars actually debate this question. So there are certain Johns that we can identify with a great deal of clarity. The first one is John the Baptist. And he was Jesus's older cousin. He was about 6 months older than Jesus. And he is the one who prepared the way for Jesus's ministry through his own ministry, which had been prophesied in the Old Testament. And he's distinguished by the fact he's called the Baptist because he would go out and baptize people. And whenever you see a John in the early parts of the Gospels who is baptizing people, that's the one that's being talked about. He's also known for having been imprisoned and executed, and his head was famously placed on a platter. So that's one of the Johns. The next John that we meet in the Gospels is John, the son of Zebedee. Zebedee was a fisherman in the town of Capernaum on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee, and he apparently had a sizable household, including servants and at least two sons, James and John, and they were fishermen. They were in the fishing business with their father. They became some of Jesus's first disciples and core disciples. They were among the 12 apostles, and Jesus nicknamed them Boanerges, or Sons of Thunder. And this John is often thought to be the author of the fourth gospel. And it's also held that after the books of the New Testament, he went to Ephesus in Asia Minor, where he died. Then there's another John that we meet in the fourth gospel. Now, he's not actually called John in the fourth gospel. He refers to himself as the disciple Jesus loved. And his identity is rather mysterious because he's keeping it a mystery. It was obviously known to the first readers of his gospel because at the end he mentions that there was a rumor that he was not going to die before the second coming. And obviously he defuses that rumor and says that's not what Jesus said. So obviously he expected his readers to know who he was if they were aware of that rumor that he needs to bother defusing it. But what he says is rather mysterious in various places, and there's some reason to think he may not be John, the son of Zebedee. One of the reasons for that is that he mentions the sons of Zebedee being present at an event where they went fishing on the Sea of Galilee. This is at the very end of the gospel. He mentions the sons of Zebedee being present, but he seems to mention himself separately from them. Mm-hmm. Also, he seems to know the high priest in Jerusalem personally, because when Jesus is betrayed, he's immediately given access to the high priest's house to come and follow into the household, whereas Peter is not. And John tells us, the author of the gospel tells us, that this disciple was known to the high priest. And he then had to go back and get Peter access to the courtyard. So a fisherman from Galilee, a lower class fisherman guy from way up north, probably wouldn't know the high priest or be given such instant access to his house. So that could suggest this John is a member of the Jerusalem aristocracy, mm-hmm. perhaps even a priest himself. This also could be suggested by the fact that he only appears, with a couple of exceptions, in the Jerusalem area in John's gospel. He doesn't go traveling with them on a regular basis. So this figure is mysterious. He's sometimes, by scholars, called John of Jerusalem. He also is sometimes identified with a figure that we know about from some early second century writings called John the Presbyter, distinct from John the Apostle. So that's a possibility. Now, other people will say, no, this is all John, son of Zebedee. And maybe it is, but there's a possibility it's a different John. In the book of Acts, we meet a couple of people named John. One of them is a young man in Jerusalem. We meet him in Acts chapter 12, and his name is John, but he also has a Latin name, Marcus. And so this is John Mark. And because there are so many Johns running around, it was a very popular name in first century Jewish society, he gets called Mark most of the time. And we read about him in Acts and in some of Paul's and Peter's letters. And he's the author of the second gospel. But his birth name, his Hebrew name, is also John. The last one I'm thinking of off the top of my head, there's also a high priest named John, who is not a Christian, it appears, that we also meet at one point in the book of Acts when the apostles are placed on trial in front of the Jewish ruling council, the Sanhedrin. So bunches of Johns.
So Sherry, it's not at all unlikely that Sherry or anyone else would be confused by who all these Johns are.
It can be a little confusing.
It really is confusing, yeah. But we have to take a quick break, so we'll be right back with more right after this. Sherry, thanks so much for that call. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Open Forum right after this.
A while back, I had a nice little chat with some Jehovah Witness ladies, and they tried to justify their claim to be Christian by saying the early Christians didn't believe Jesus was God. Is this true? Well, of course not. Let me share a few examples. Take John 1:1, where John describes Jesus as the Word and writes the Word was God. Now, in order to get around this, the JWs translate the phrase as the Word was a God. But this is based on a misunderstanding of Greek grammar. Consider also Colossians 2:9, where St. Paul writes, "For in him, that is Jesus, the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily." In 1 Corinthians 8:6, Paul describes Jesus as the one through whom we exist. Isn't God the one ultimately responsible for the existence of things?
So, contrary to what the JWs think, to be Christian, you must believe Jesus is God. I'm Carlo Broussard with A Ready Reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
Well, I don't think we're like the typical college students because we really hang out at our campus ministry and everything. It's amazing about how much more connected you feel. We share really cool articles from actually you guys, EWTN, and like what you were saying about evangelization. So that's really nice.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Don't want you to forget. As a matter of fact, Carrie Beck, who is in charge of these things, stopped me in the hall to say, make sure you let people know that store-wide summer sale is still on until the last day of this month. And store-wide summer sale is where everything, books, audio, DVDs, tracks, digital products, all 10 to 25% off, some more than that. Including all of Jimmy Akin's books and DVDs, a stack of which I have next to me if you're watching the show at home. Just use the promo code SAVE when you check out, and you get an extra 10% off all those already discounted prices. That's SAVE at checkout at shop.catholic.com. And Jimmy, we'll talk about your Catholic Answers Magazine article next hour.
Okay.
I was confused.
Okay.
888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. And it is open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and our next caller is Kat in Wichita, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Thanks for downloading the app, Kat. Your question for Jimmy.
Hi. So it's a sexual ethics question.
Okay.
It's actually my husband's. We want to know, how is NFP different from just contraception when we're only using the infertile days to have sex? How is that different?
It's different in that it works with God's design for human sexuality rather than frustrating that design. So the difference is one of means rather than a difference of end. In both cases, if you're using either NFP or contraception to avoid having a child right now, the end is the same. The goal is the same, not having a child when you have marital relations. But you're doing it by different means. Now, some means are with any given choice you make, some means may be legitimate, but not others. And this is the truth behind the famous saying, the ends do not justify the means. Just because you have a good end does not mean that it justifies any and every means of getting to that end. For example, it's possible for a given territory to become overpopulated, so that people are starving and things like that and suffering as a result of the overpopulation. Their economy isn't developed enough to support that many people, and they're really hurting. And you want to do something to fix the problem of overpopulation. That's your goal. Well, one way of doing that is genocide. You could just kill everybody in that territory or kill half of them, you know?
Thanos.
Like Thanos, yeah, or Hitler or Stalin or Pol Pot. And so, obviously, that's an unacceptable means of achieving an end. Even if the end of let's avoid the overpopulation, let's, you know, deal with that somehow, you want to use other means to deal with it, like maybe immigration or bringing in new technology and new economic opportunities so people can feed themselves. But what you don't want to do is just start killing people. And that's an example of how even a good end may be something where certain means are not appropriate for it. And from a Christian point of view, we want to work with the design that God has given us, the way he's designed our species to work compared to other species. In the case of many species, actually, the only time that females are sexually receptive is during their period of fertility. The rest of the time, they don't want anything to do with reproductive behavior. It's just when they're fertile. But that's not how God designed our species. He designed us, and you can say he used evolution or did it directly, whatever you want, one way or another, the way he built us, we're designed so that human females are sexually receptive most of the time. And even not every night, but most of the time. And that tells us that for our species, it's okay to have marital intercourse during times when we're not fertile. It's also okay not to have intercourse when we are fertile. That's something that's illustrated by the fact that human males do not become overpoweringly obsessed during a fertile period the way members of some species do.
Yeah,
and
like dogs.
Yeah, exactly, or cats. And so consequently, it's we can have legitimate relations in infertile periods, and we can refrain from having intercourse during fertile periods. Both of those are things that are reasonable for our species, given the way we're made. And God also gave us the intellect to judge when it's appropriate to do one or the other. And so we can use this gift of intellect to discern, should we pursue having a baby right now? And if the answer is no, then we shouldn't obviously have sex during the fertile period, but that doesn't stop us from having sex during the infertile period. And so this is a way of working together with the way our species is set up and a way of honoring God's design in our species without frustrating it and breaking it and doing things to injure or damage or replace that process with some other thing.
Kat?
Cool.
No.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Just got a cool. That's
yeah.
Good. Let's go to Stephen in Cincinnati listening on 740 AM. Stephen, we are coming close to the end of the show, so if you can phrase your question fairly quickly, Jimmy can get you an answer before the top of the hour.
All right. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, the Bible references that greed is bad.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes this summer, I went to a lot of different festivals, all which were church festivals, a lot of Catholic festivals, and there was unbelievable amounts of gambling there. I believe that they used it as a form of raising money for the church,
mm-hmm.
but I feel like it's hypocritical that the church is promoting gambling and basically allowing sinning for the church when they don't promote gambling other ways. So,
okay. Well, actually, the Catholic Church doesn't have a problem with gambling in principle, whether it's in like a parish fundraising situation or in other situations. Gambling and greed are not the same thing. Greed is an inordinate desire for money or wealth. And obviously, anything that's inordinate, anything that's out of proportion, is bad. But gambling, at least when it's done in a healthy way, is just entertainment. It's a little exciting to have a little bit of risk involved in something with some kind of reward involved. And that risk-reward uncertainty is part of what makes it an entertaining activity. Nobody, by winning a bingo session at a parish, is going to get rich unless it's super high-stakes bingo. And you shouldn't even be playing it unless you can afford to lose a little bit of money, because on average in gambling, you're going to lose at least as much as you win on average, if not more. And so if you think about it in terms of entertainment, it's no different than, paying $15 to see a movie and having an entertaining experience, paying, $15 to play some bingo or for a lottery or something like that. In fact, is essentially the same thing. In fact, with lotteries, most people don't really have any expectation of winning. The reason they're giving is because they want to support the institution that's running the lottery. And yeah, maybe if they win something, that would be nice. But really, that's not their focus, because they recognize only a handful of people are going to win anything, and it's probably not going to be them. So the church doesn't have a problem with gambling in principle. Obviously, if you can't afford it, you shouldn't do it. If you have an addiction to this form of entertainment, that's a problem. But in principle, it's not a problem in and of itself, and it's not the same thing as greed.
Stephen, you did a great job phrasing that question quickly. Really appreciate it. Gave us an opportunity to get a full answer in. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and he'll be back next hour. So if you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't dialed yet and you have a question about the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church, 888-31-TRUTH is our number. That's 888-318-7884. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.